Look forward now to hearing Brother Phil's second address on Hebrews chapter 5.
Having then demonstrated from Scripture that the priesthood of Christ was greater than that of Aaron, because he was first son of God and then priest of the Melchizedek order, the apostle now continues in chapter 5 to consider again his experiences. He considers them perhaps in a little more detail. Hebrews 5 verse 7. Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard in that he feared. So Paul then refers to the days of his flesh. Paul is referring to the mortal life of Jesus when he walked this earth nearly 2,000 years ago. We must not think that being Son of God made it easy for him, or that it lightened the burden in some way. We believe it did not. No doubt, Jesus was endowed with exceptional intelligence and a very quick mind, so that he could very easily absorb the scriptures and understand the things which are written concerning himself. We have evidence of this, do we not? If we go back to Luke chapter 2, to those very well-known words concerning Jesus at the age of 12, when he was conversing with the doctors in the temple. Luke chapter 2 and verse 46. It came to pass that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors, both hearing them and asking them questions. And all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. When they saw him, they were amazed, and his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing. And he said unto them, How is it that ye sought me? Wist ye not that I must be about my father's business? So his understanding of the scriptures, even at that early age of 12 years, exceeded that of anybody else, even those learned doctors in the temple. He fully understood what was his father's business which he must fulfil. But what was the effect of this intelligence? Well, it meant, as we said in our first address, that he would have had a greater appreciation of the difference between right and wrong. As we said, we usually sin because we act first and think later. But with the quick perception which Jesus had, that wouldn't have been possible. And that means, when we think about it, that he couldn't have committed a sin which hadn't been a willful sin. He couldn't have sinned without being fully conscious that he was sinning. And also it would have developed within his mind at a total abhorrence of evil, which would have caused great mental anguish. He would have developed, would he not, to a greater degree than any of us at this side of the kingdom can hope to develop, the mind of the Father, which cannot tolerate evil in any form. And yet he had to live in a world surrounded by evil. But also he would have understood from a child that he was to be a sacrifice for sins. Crucifixion was a well-known form of execution in Israel at that time. It's by no means unlikely that the child Jesus had witnessed such sins. And he knew that the day would come when such a death would come to him. Now we, brethren and sisters, are mercifully ignorant of evils yet to come. And yet, very often, the thought of the mere possibility of something evil happening to us causes us great anxiety. But Jesus knew for certain what was to happen to him. And surely he must have suffered the crucifixion mentally long before he did so as a fact. No wonder then that he prayed to his Father with strong crying and tears to save him from death. Going over to the 22nd chapter of Luke, we recall his prayer in the garden. Luke 22 verse 39. And he came out and went as he was wont to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples also followed him. And when he was at the place, he said unto them, Pray that ye enter not into temptation. And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's cast, and kneeled down and prayed, saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling down to the ground. But before this, we know that he had spent whole nights in prayer. And no doubt his coming ordeal would have been a frequent subject of such prayers. This we do not believe would have been the first occasion when he had prayed in that way. But the apostle says that he was heard in that he feared. He respected the will of his Father, and so he received strength to overcome. And so he was saved to rise again from death, to ascend to his Father's right hand. He was not saved from dying, but he was saved out of death. He was a priest who had prepared the body, his own body, as a sacrifice. He had then offered himself as a sacrifice for the sins of all that put their trust in him. And the next two verses in Hebrews chapter 5 elaborate on these two facts. Hebrews 5 and verse 8. Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. Yes, the fact that he was Son of God, which endowed him with exceptional abilities, as we have just described, did not mean that he was by nature obedient. He was of human nature, and so it was his natural tendency to disobey and to sin. He therefore had to learn how to be obedient. And the word which is translated learned is similar to the word which is translated disciple. So Jesus himself then had to become a disciple. He had to learn to be obedient. He had to follow, as it were, a training program. And that training program consisted of the things which he suffered, as we read at the end of verse 8. But the things which he suffered, which the apostle is referring to there, were not his trial and crucifixion. The trial and crucifixion didn't train him to be obedient. That training had to be complete before his trial and crucifixion. Now the sufferings referred to in this verse were to train him so that he would become obedient even to the stake. Those sufferings were the things which he suffered, experienced. In fact, the word rendered suffered can also be rendered experienced. The things which happened to him during his life trained him so that when the great crisis came upon him, he would obey. Those things which he suffered, which he experienced, were the means by which his offering was prepared. And that was essential, that the offering was properly prepared. An acceptable offering had to be unblemished. The Aaronic priests had to obey implicitly the laws relating to the offerings. A mistake in any detail of the high priest on the Day of Atonement would have resulted in his death when he passed the veil. The dead priest would have brought no redemption to Israel. And so this priest, if he had not learned obedience, would have remained dead when he was crucified. And a dead Jesus would have brought no redemption. The efficacy of the sacrifice of Christ was not in his death as such. Many people have died for the truth. Many have sacrificed their lives for the faith. Some did before Christ, many of the prophets. Some afterwards, we can think of Stephen. But their deaths were not acceptable as an offering for sin, not even for their own sins, let alone the sins of others. But the reason why Christ's offering was efficacious was that he had first conquered sin. And so he, as a perfect high priest, could offer a completely unblemished sacrifice. Verse 9. And being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation unto all them that obey him. The word perfect, as no doubt we know, means complete. It applies to Jesus both as sacrifice and as high priest. A sacrifice because there was no blemish found in him, but also as high priest. And the emphasis in this chapter is particularly in respect of him being high priest. And Jesus was the complete high priest. We saw in our first address his experiences of human nature were more comprehensive than any other son of Adam, so that he had this complete sympathy. Yet he also completely overcame that nature. And he allows himself to be trained by his experiences in life so that he would overcome, so that he became the complete, the perfect high priest. And having achieved that position, he became the author of eternal salvation. And chapter 2 of Hebrews and verse 10, Jesus is described as the captain of our salvation. The original word, which is there translated captain, the word archigos, is in fact translated author in chapter 12 of Hebrews and verse 2. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the stake, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. But it's a different word which is translated author in chapter 5 and verse 9. The word archigos means a chief leader. It tells us that Jesus has shown the way to salvation. That he was, as it were, a pioneer who has found a route through hitherto uncharted territory. In our verse, the word is aetios. That word means the cause. This is the only place in the New Testament that that Greek word occurs. So Jesus had not simply discovered the way to attain salvation, and so is able to lead others along that way, as the word archigos implies, but he has in fact actually caused salvation to come into being. He has conquered sinful nature. And salvation was not possible until that victory had been won. It wasn't there to be found until it had been conquered. There was no means of salvation. The apostle here is telling us that he has been the cause of eternal salvation unto all them that obey him. And that fact is equally true for those living before Christ as for us. The faithful ones living before Christ died in faith of the promise that such a victory would be won. We live in the knowledge that it has been won. And the salvation which he has brought into being is not for all. It is for them that obey him. In other words, the training which he underwent must be the training to which we must be subjected. And if it was necessary for Jesus to be trained in obedience, brothers and sisters, how much more necessary is it for us? But if we are prepared to allow the experiences which come upon us in our day-to-day life to train us to obey, then we also will receive that salvation. In chapter 12, Paul goes on, as we know, to go into the matter of chastening or discipline in some great detail. Here he has simply stated the principle. The experiences which come upon us are a form of chastening, a training, that we may learn to obey. And having learnt to obey, then we will receive that eternal salvation. That salvation which is related to life in the age which he will establish on his return to this earth. Now, much of what we have said, brothers and sisters, regarding these last three verses were in fact a repetition of what we said in our first address. They may well have indeed have been a repetition of what have been said by brethren speaking on previous chapters. If this is so, it is because Paul himself has repeated these truths in somewhat different wordings. And he has repeated them because they are important truths. They are important, so important that they bear constant repetition. You might say that they are the main fundamentals of all our fundamental doctrines. For unless we have a clear understanding of the nature of Christ and his role both as high priest and sacrifice, then we cannot hope to participate in that salvation and share his throne when he comes as king. And his argument here culminates in a further repetition. Verse 10. Called of God and high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And yet that is not quite a repetition. It is second reference to Psalm 110 verse 4. But whereas in verse 6 he made a direct quotation, here he adds something to that verse, as he will do in chapter 6 verse 20 and in chapter 7 verse 11, and returns to a direct quotation in chapter 7 verse 17. And the addition to the psalm is that expression, called of God. For those words do not appear in Psalm 110, verse 4. But as it appears in English, it looks like a repetition of what he'd said earlier in the chapter. Almost as if he'd been repeating what he'd said in verses 4 to 6, but omitting the words, as was Aaron, to thou art. If you look at the end of verse 4, called of God, and in verse 6, thou, called of God, and high priest after the order of Melchizedek. It looks like a repetition, does it not? But as we said earlier, there are two different words in this chapter translated called, and the one used in verse 10 is a different word from that which is used in verse 4. We said that one was kallio, meaning to call or collect someone to perform a particular function. But the word in verse 10 is prosagorio, and it is its only occurrence in the New Testament. And the word literally means called by name, and it is a word which is appropriate to the bestowing of a title. Now, when the Queen of England bestows the rank of knighthood on someone, she says, arise, sir, whatever his name is. And she has, by that means, bestowed upon the person a title. And that is the principle here. God has bestowed the title, high priest after the order of Melchizedek, upon Jesus Christ. And in so doing, he has demonstrated the superiority of that order publicly. The calling of verse 4 could quite easily be a personal call between God and the one called. The God we saw called Moses, he spoke to Moses, we read. No one else heard it, although it's recorded for us, but it was a personal call between two. But the giving of a title is a public declaration, and that is the force of that word in verse 10. Publicly declaring him to be an high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Immediately end of chapter 6, the apostle uses another significant word, saying that Jesus was made a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, and then proceeds in chapter 7 to show how he was so made. But that is for further speakers to consider. But the apostle has now, when he's come to the end of verse 10 of chapter 5, established his first point in respect of the priesthood of Christ. He has established the fact that he was first selected and called to a certain office, that he then underwent a training of period to prepare him for that office. He was then obedient to his father having successfully completed his training, and so now he is publicly declared to be high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And at this point, we might have expected him to have told us what the priesthood after the order of Melchizedek involved. But Paul finds it necessary to delay that consideration. And so we read in verse 11, "Of whom we have many things to say, and hard to be uttered, seeing ye are dull of hearing." As Paul has much to say on this subject, and indeed he spends most of chapter 7 on it, but he says that it is hard to be uttered, or hard of interpretation, and that difficulty wasn't because he had any problem in understanding the matter or found it difficult to express his thoughts. The difficulty lied with the Hebrews. The problem was that the Hebrews, he says, are dull of hearing. Literally it means they were sluggish to hear. And the word translated dull occurs in chapter 6 and verse 12, where it's rendered slothful. He says, "That ye be not slothful, but followers of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises." In other words, he tells the Hebrews that they were mentally lazy. They were so involved in the affairs of this life that they couldn't be bothered to study the word. But these words have not been included in this place just to tell us of the deficiencies of the Hebrews. They are included, brethren and sisters, as a warning to ourselves. For we live in an age, do we not, when the brotherhood is beset by problems. There are those who teach false doctrines, there are those who engage in unscriptural practices, and most of the brotherhood appears unwilling to do anything about it. May it be because we also are dull of hearing, sluggish to hear the word. Like people of Israel to whom Isaiah spoke, as we read in the 30th chapter of his prophecy. Isaiah chapter 30 spoke to the people, warning them of the judgments to come upon Jerusalem. But what was the attitude of the people? Chapter 30, verse 9. "That this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of Yahweh, which say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits." And again the prophet Jeremiah in the 5th chapter, all the people around him weren't indulging in idolatry, particularly in the 5th chapter, which we believe was uttered at the time of Josiah, but they didn't want their peaceful lives disturbed. Jeremiah chapter 5 and verse 30. "A wonderful and horrible thing is committed in the land. The prophets prophesy falsely, and the priests bear rule by their means, and my people love to have it so. What will you do in the end thereof?" Chapter 6, verse 13. "For from the least of them, even unto the greatest of them, every one is given to covetousness. And from the prophet, even unto the priest, every one dealeth falsely. They have healed also the hurt of the daughter of my people slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace." The problem with those people was that they couldn't be bothered to study the word for themselves, and so they fell an easy prey to those who misrepresented the word. No doubt the priests of Baal were very friendly people. They only wanted to believe and do what appealed to them. So they went about and did what they wanted. And this, the just judgments which Yahweh said would come upon them, were not liked by the people. They didn't like to hear these words. And Paul met the same problem in the ecclesia of the first century, particularly amongst the Hebrews, who were vulnerable to the false doctrines being preached by the Judaizers. Now, there's only one way to protect ourselves against false teaching, and that is to thoroughly study the truth regularly. We need to consistently and constantly remind ourselves of the truth we believe and regularly study to deepen our understanding. Go back to Hebrews chapter 5, you see that that is what the brethren and sisters to whom Paul was writing had failed to do. Hebrews 5 and verse 12. For when for the time ye ought to be teachers, ye have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God, and are become such as have need of milk, and not of strong meat. They've been in the ecclesia long enough to become teachers of others. That, of course, is why they have been called, why we have been called to the ecclesia. In our current organisation, when one has expressed an interest in the truth, a brother or sister instructs them in our fundamental doctrines until they are able to give a good confession of faith and pass through the waters of baptism. They then take their place in the ecclesia and participate in the breaking of bread, in fellowship with those who have now become their brethren and sisters. So often there's a tendency to think that once baptized, their period of learning has finished. But nothing could be further from the truth. It is then necessary to study those fundamental doctrines more deeply, to get to grips with the word of prophecy. And never, never during our time of mortality should we stop learning. One of the wonders of the truth is that the more we know about it, the more we realise that we have yet to learn. Having been baptised, we must also strive to be able to teach others. To teach others interested in the truth, and indeed to teach one another. For we are not an organisation which has a clergy that does all the teaching and a laity which does all the learning. We should all, in various ways, teach one another so we are all teaching and all learning. But the Hebrews, to whom Paul was writing, hadn't done this. They reached a certain point and then they said, well, we know enough. And if we stop studying the word, we don't, as it were, remain on a plateau. It's not like a person climbing a mountain or having reached a certain altitude decides he's had enough and stops there. As far as the study of the word is concerned, once we stop climbing, we start slipping back again. We forget what we have learned, and what is worse, we are liable to be led astray by those who teach falsely. So then we learn all the wrong things. And in the opening verses of chapter 6, Paul issues a very dire warning to those who fall away. The Hebrews, it seems, had slipped back a long way, for it was necessary that they should be taught again the first principles of the oracles of God. Put it in modern terms, that they should go through the declaration again and the statement of faith and relearn all the fundamental doctrines. And is that not the position of many in the brotherhood today? Quite apart from those who actually teach error, many have a very hazy idea of what our statement of faith contains. And so Paul uses this analogy of the weaning of a child. They had been weaned but slipped back. Now if this was to happen to a person naturally, it would denote a very grave illness. It would denote a very serious disorder of the digestive system. A state indeed from which death would probably result. The weaning of a babe usually proceeds without too many problems, as that is the natural process. But to attempt to re-wean someone who has slipped back to a babe's digestion is a very different situation. For they have a body that needs strong meat, and they cannot get sufficient nourishment from milk. And it's not difficult, is it, to see the scriptural application of this. We need, brothers and sisters, to care very much for our spiritual digestion. Once having been weaned from the weaned from the milk of the word, let us not slip back. If we do, the consequences for our spiritual welfare are bleak indeed. But milk, of course, has its uses. Verse 13. For everyone that useth milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. In the natural world, it is essential for the newly born to have milk. And so the milk of the word is essential for the newly baptized. The margin, we notice, gives the alternative, hath no experience, for that word, unskillful. Now, Paul uses this same analogy in the first epistle which he wrote to the Corinthians and the third chapter. First Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 1. And I, brethren, could not speak unto you as unto spiritual, but as unto carnal, even as unto babes in Christ. I have fed you with milk and not with meat, for hitherto ye were not able to bear it, neither yet now are ye able, for ye are yet carnal. For where is there is among you envy and strife and divisions? Are ye not carnal and walk as men? The Corinthians, like the Hebrews, had failed to make sufficient progress. They were still as babes in Christ, and so Paul felt unable to teach them the deeper things of the truth. And Peter also, in his first epistle, evidently is writing to those who had made little progress in their study of the word. First epistle, chapter 2, the first verse. Wherefore, laying aside all malice and all guile and hypocrisies and envies and all evil speakings, as newborn babes desire the sincere milk of the word, that ye may grow thereby, if so be ye have tasted that the Lord is gracious. So those who are new to the truth, those who have failed to progress, must first desire and imbibe the milk of the word. But after a time they must be weaned to the strong meat. Nevertheless, of course, even in the natural age, certain quantity of milk in some form remains as part of our daily diet, so we should never feel that we have reached the state when we can put on one side our fundamental doctrines. What's useful for us to remind ourselves of them? We mustn't have that constant diet. We must study the deeper things. Verse 14. But strong meat belongeth to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. So as we mature, we take more of the strong meat and less of the milk until we reach full age. Perfect original means. Mature. Kindred word is used in verse 9 relating to Christ. But we will never fully reach that stage unless and until we are accepted at the judgment seat. But we must, during our lives now, make some progress towards maturity. And so our spiritual diet should progressively contain a larger proportion of strong meat. But what is this strong meat? The word translated strong basically means solid. Well, the word which is translated meat does not refer to flesh as we normally understand the word meat, but the basic idea behind the word is nourishment. And so we need to take solid nourishment rather than liquid nourishment, something which we need to chew over and meditate upon, rather than what just slips down easily. As the apostle says in this verse, those who have their senses exercised. But the important thing is that it must be nourishment. Returning to the figure of a mother weaning her child, she takes very good care, does she not, that the solid food is nourishing. She doesn't say to the child, as soon as the child is weaned, well, you can now eat solid food, go eat and take whatever you might find attractive, because she knows that if she does, the child will very likely quickly develop a diet of deadly nightshade mixed with poisonous fungi, and the results would be dire indeed. That is what would happen in the natural world. Nor indeed, if she is sensible, does she feed the child with a great quantity of what we come to know colloquially as junk food, because that wouldn't provide much nourishment either. And yet there is much spiritual poison, there is much spiritual junk food around in the world today, in the ecclesias indeed, as well as outside. And it is precisely what many brothers and sisters do in a spiritual sense, provide these things for the young in the truth. There is only one source of nourishing spiritual food, and that is the Word of God. From this we first obtain the milk of the Word, and from there we obtain the solid food of the Word. And food from any other source is dangerous. We read, if we not, I'm sure most of us in this room have read, the latest issue of the Christadelphian, a letter signed by 115 brethren, claiming that Christadelphians have always been distinguished by their habit of thinking for themselves on religious matters, and it would be a disaster if our freedom of thought and speech were to be crushed. This statement, brethren and sisters, we believe to be utterly false. Christadelphians hitherto have surely been distinguished by moulding their thoughts in religious matters in accordance with the Word of God. When we were baptized, we put aside our individual freedom of thought and speech. In other words, we ceased feeding on the poisonous food which appears attractive to the flesh, and instead have fed upon the Word. The words which we have just quoted, we believe, are at the very centre of the problems facing our brotherhood today. False doctrines which are preached are simply the end result of taking this freedom as far as it will go, beyond which many perhaps have not yet dared to go. And the problem with the Hebrews was the same. They had in their midst the free thinkers who, like the Judaistic traditions which appealed to the flesh, those whose minds were thus poisoned against the true understanding of the law given to Moses. But let us, brethren and sisters, let us rather take good, solid nourishment from the Word. Let us chew this over in our minds. Let us thoroughly digest its message. For then, as that chapter ends, we shall learn, as Jesus learned, to discern between good and evil. The evil we will reject, the good we will absorb, until when our Master returns, we shall be fully mature and acceptable as priests after the order of Melchizedek.